listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, and health, and every week on this show we talk about all of the interconnected things that affect our personal and community and planetary well-being here on Connect the Dots. We talk about policies, we talk about practices, we talk about industries, we talk about activism, we talk about opportunities for connecting the dots and seeing the vast interconnections between each of us, all of our species, all other species, and our world here, planet Earth. Each week on the show, I talk with different thought leaders, experts, journalists, authors, environmentalists, health practitioners, and foodies, and a whole range of people in our interconnected world that have special knowledge and expertise about different facets of all of the things that make up our living planet, as well as how they interconnect. And on today's show, we have a returning guest who will be talking about some very important intersections. My guest today is Judith D. Schwartz. She's a journalist and author. She's been on the program before discussing her earlier book, Cows Save the Planet, and we'll probably highlight some of the understandings from that again today as well. Her more recent book is Water in Plain Sight. And today we're going to be talking with Judith D. Schwartz about the role of water. There's, you know, as one of the first journalists to do news cycle and regular ongoing coverage over many years of fracking and pipelines and the kind of harsh ill effects upon our water supply of energy practices, as well as, of course, their climatic effects. You know, we've been kind of protecting water, and we featured many water protectors on Connect the Dots. But, you know, it's also important to really get to know water, to understand beyond the tap water that comes out that we drink and that we use or that we bathe in or that we swim in or that we admire for its serenity or its exhilaration if we're by the ocean, to really understand how water works and flows and what it does and can do for us here on planet Earth. And that's what we're going to be talking about today with Judith D. Schwartz. Happy to say so. Welcome, Judy, to Connect the Dots. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Allison.
So, you know, it's kind of there's been a kind of ongoing trend in your understanding as a kind of pioneering journalist covering a topic that we've been featuring quite a lot over the past year and more on Connect the Dots, which is, you know, how our choices about agriculture, about environmental sustainability don't only begin and end with, say, recycling our plastic bottles or anything like that. But actually, the ways that we grow, the industries that we support or transition from, all of that has tremendous impact on, you know, the climate and our actual living viability here on planet Earth. On this show, we've talked a lot about fossil fuels. But even though we've been kind of protecting water and understanding intuitively why this is so important, we really, I don't think, have ever really had a big picture of how the water cycle on planet Earth functions, how it affects us, what its potential is, and, you know, what we can support and push for, and, you know is the right direction when, you know, we're bombarded by different kinds of initiatives, you know, corporate or, you know, kind of, you know, sustainable or different things so that we can be more discerning. So, you know, how, you know, share with us a little bit how your journey into looking into the planetary water cycle originated and, you know, where it's taken you.
Okay, well, thank you. All right, so as you mentioned, I had written a book about soil called Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. And basically, that was kind of a soil's eye view of the world. It was a look at soil as a hub for our many environmental, economic, and social challenges and for solutions. Because, I mean, much to my surprise, as someone, you know, who doesn't farm and, you know, like hasn't been engaged in that world, I discovered that, you know, the importance of soil and how for so many of these big challenges, there's an alternative scenario which turns on how we treat the soil, how we treat the surface of the earth. So anyway, so I you know, emerging from the process of that book, the reason, there are two main reasons that I decided to write a book about water, okay? So the first is that it struck me that in dealing with our water challenges, you know, specifically I was thinking about, you know, this is what was kind of up front and center at this point, was the big California drought in about 2014, 2015. And what struck me is that all of the focus was on what does or doesn't come down from the sky, you know, like whether it's going to rain or not. It was all about rain and snow melt, which is, I mean, of course that's important. But what was never mentioned was the ground. So, you know, no one talked about land degradation, which is a big untold story about the lack of water, scarcity in a place like California. No one was talking about the, the paved over, built over surfaces, which meant that the ground could not absorb and hold the water. And so, you know, I thought there was a huge, huge missed opportunities. I'll just give you one example, okay? So there was at the height of the California drought, when people were wondering, you know, what are the implications for our nation's food supply, given that about 50% of our produce, the produce in our grocery stores, comes from California, there was an article that had this really catchy headline, which was, to get past the drought, California needs 11 trillion Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of rainfall. Okay, and that amused me because, you know, I mean, you know, all right, that because land wasn't mentioned. Okay, so let's say
it's just like we're an open mouth that needs this water, but we're not thinking about how we use it, how we retain it, or any of that.
Exactly. So if you get all that rain and it falls on, you know, on parking lots and land that's been over-farmed and is pumped with chemicals and can't hold any water, well, then a few months later, you'll be back in a drought. But if that rain falls over well-maintained, let's say, rangelands that are being managed very well and the soil is rich in carbon, which means it acts like a sponge, well, then maybe you only need a few billion swimming pools worth of water, you know. So anyway, that to me just kind of, really established the disconnect. So I felt that there was a real opportunity to highlight the land-water connection. So that's one reason that I was motivated to write this book, okay?
That makes huge sense. You know, and actually, you know, the mentality when these kinds of problems arise is like episodic. You know, we take a snapshot of this problem in this moment, and then it's like, how do we address this problem? But the whole model of thinking that you so correctly zoomed in on is it's crisis oriented, it's consumptive, and it's episodic. So that, you know, it's like the question is not how do we make best use of the water that could be available to us, and how do we, you know, sustain its presence. But it's like, you know, how can I fill my cup right now? You know, it's a consumptive approach to something that's ecological. What would an ecological perspective on that question look like?
In a very simple phrase, how do we make our rainfall? How can we, that's like a, you know, I have to do something immediately. How can we ensure I mean, you know, that kind of reactive and almost control oriented. But how can mm-hmm. we ensure that what rainfall descends upon this our land is effective? So it's not how much rain you get, but how can that rain be effective? That is a phrase from Alan Savory, who calls attention to this. And Alan Savory is the fellow who developed the model of holistic management, in which livestock. So I wrote about him extensively, and actually for this book, I got a chance to go spend time with him in Zimbabwe. So holistic management is often not, it's a decision-making framework in which, you look at livestock as a vehicle for large-scale land restoration. So that's not too much of a deviation.
Who are not familiar with Alan Savory, a little about him, because I kind of feel like almost every other day, there are kind of beliefs about what constitutes an environmentally sound food supply agricultural method. And then there are new innovations that, you know, a lot of people formed their ideas about this 10 years ago or 8 years ago, or informed by people who did, who may not be as aware of the new developments. And, you know, Alan Savory has certainly been a pioneer. Can you kind of orient our listeners a little bit to him and his way of thinking?
Sure, I'm happy to do so. And, you know, I do want to mention that I was just in New York. You know, this is just as an example of how the understanding of how animals how animals and landscapes interact, and how proper management can create a scenario in which the animals are a positive influence on the land. I was just speaking at Eileen Fisher Clothing Company, and they are bringing out a line of wool in which the production of the wool is environmentally beneficial. So I mention that because businesses, industries, you know, so there are some forward-looking entities that are beginning to not only understand these concepts but apply them. Okay, so I'll just give a little snapshot introduction of Alan Savory, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's a fellow. He is now in his early 80s, and he grew up in Zimbabwe, which was then Rhodesia. He loved wildlife more than anything. Oh, goodness, I'm sorry. That was my dog. I think he...
Well, that's wildlife entering into the conversation.
Exactly. So Alan grew up in Zimbabwe. And, you know, as a young man, he became aware that the landscape was not as vibrant as it had been, and that there weren't as many animals. And this saddened him greatly. And, you know, he wondered why. So he joined the National Park Service at a very young age, and this was a matter under discussion in the service. So the animal, there aren't as many animals, they aren't as healthy. Okay, clearly they determined there were too many animals on the land. I mean, that seemed to make sense, that they were using up the land somehow. So they partitioned the landscape, and they created areas where they would keep the animals out. Now, what happened was, when they kept the animals out, the land deteriorated. So this made no sense if the problem was that there were too many animals. So Alan, you know, held on to this and kept asking the question, what's going on here? Clearly there was more going on in the dynamics of animals and land. So over many years, he observed animals on the landscape. He also read a lot of history and saw that historically, like, there were so many. I mean, I've had the good fortune to go to Southern Africa, actually, over many years now, because my husband is South African, and so I've seen that landscape. And he saw that historically, like, the numbers of wildebeest and zebra and giraffe and, you know, all, and kudu and water buffalo, Cape buffalo, and all these, you know, really, you know, beautiful animals, the numbers were vast, almost beyond comprehension. And that's when the land was very healthy. So over time, he came up with a few kind of core concepts, and I'll share these. One is that grazing animals and grasslands co-evolved so that the land needs the animals in the same way that the animals need the land. And that, you know, I say grasslands, that might sound to us, you know, people listening to the radio right now, like, oh, that's a place like elsewhere. But these are ecosystems all over the world. About a third of the world's landmass is, or non-ice-covered landmass, is made of grassland. So we're talking about the prairies in North America, the savanna in Africa, the pampas in South America, the steppes in Asia, Eurasia. So that's pretty significant to understand how these ecosystems function. The second insight is that while land can certainly be overgrazed, that there can be situations in which animals are having too much of an impact, so that it becomes a negative cycle. Also, land can be undergrazed, that land needs some kind of animal impact, and there's a dynamic in which the land is healthy. So that if you partition, that's what he observed when they kept the animals out and the land deteriorated. And then what's really interesting, and here I can explain a little bit of the biological process, is that there's something that there are different kind of landscapes that he understood in terms of the term brittle, like the brittleness scale, so that these are dry lands that can tend towards dryness. But it's, again, just like we were talking about in California, it's not a matter of how much rain you get. Like, you know, we often think, like, you know, if a place gets a lot of rain, well, then it's not going to be a desert. But it's about the distribution of rain across the seasons, across the year. And that, an example is, all right, my husband, I mentioned, grew up in South Africa. And he remembers growing up in South Africa that it was always sunny. Then he moved to London, and he remembers London as always raining. Now, it turns out that London and Johannesburg have about the same rainfall, annual rainfall. But in Johannesburg, it all comes at once. And in the UK, in London, it's distributed fairly evenly throughout the year. So, you know, so going back to Africa, where Alan was, you know, making, you know, kind of trying to figure out how landscapes work, those are brittle landscapes when there's a distinct dry season and rainy season. And again, this is a vast portion of the planet. It's like, I mean, our Southwest is like that. So in brittle landscapes, nature had a challenge. And that challenge was how to maintain moisture in the soil, which is what keeps the ecosystem alive, the microorganisms in the soil, the plants, you know, everything keeps the system going. How do you maintain moisture in the landscape from the end of one rainy season to the beginning of the next? And the way that nature addressed that challenge was through the digestive system and behavior of grazing animals. So, you know, anyway, I just put that all out there. But the point is that animals on the landscape are really important, and we need to understand the dynamics. And because we don't have because we're here, we humans are here in such vast numbers, we have altered the landscape so that we don't have predators, native predators, the jackal and hyenas and lions and wolves, managing these plant-eating animals so that they're not, you know, eating the grasses and browsing the brush down to the ground, where we can apply those insights in a way that keep our ecosystems vibrant. So I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I just put a lot of it out there.
We have to do the right kind of stewardship. In other words, there's a stewardship and an interplay between the land, the water, the animals, and us. And,
exactly. that it's one system, basically.
So it's not like the pure land that existed before we came along and we've sort of mucked it up. It's like there always have been traditional ways that the system functioned together. So the sense that we have to, you know, kind of extricate ourselves and the animals from the system that we're harming in some way is not a complete portrait of every kind of system on a global level. And so the correct management also makes the best use of the water. So we're now, you know, we're back to our opening kind of theme and discussion of the water.
Right.
Before we go back fully to that, let me just ask a question, because there are areas of this country, as you pointed out, that are grasslands and that have that in common, you know, with other regions of the earth where there is a lot more of that kind of land. So it's actually harder for Americans to sort of understand, you know, that this, because, you know, a lot of this country is temperate in a certain kind of way, and so we don't think about that. You know, there are so many different kinds of land all throughout the world. How does, are we using the kind of land that's predominant in the U.S. in the most appropriate way? And if not, what could we be doing better? And, you know, so that would be question number one. And then second, question number two, since some of, you know, much of, a lot of food does come to us, you know, from abroad. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, some of it is domestic and some of it is international. And when we look at climate, for example, we have to look at the whole picture internationally and not impose, for example, a style of agriculture that might be more appropriate in a temperate zone in other regions of the world, because it's the one we know, because that's what our, you know, some of our farmland is like. I mean, I know this is a ridiculously broad question, but I just wonder how that plays. So, you know, first, how, you know, are we appropriately managing our more temperate zone land? Do we require a different understanding of the kind of land that exists all over the earth to get a handle on the climate and desertification problem? And are there places where we are or may potentially be misapplying our own temperate zone form of agriculture to other regions?
Absolutely. I think that's a really, really great question. And one thing that I've thought about is that if you look at where most global decision making occurs, it's in what you would call, you know, you're using the term temperate, and you know, like, you know, sticking to this, you know, Savory's understanding, non-brittle environments. Okay, so you know, where are global decisions made? Brussels, London, New York, Washington. Okay, so I think it's important to Paris. I think it's important to understand that there is that understanding of how nature functions, that decisions made there then end up applying in places where it isn't appropriate. Absolutely, there are many, many examples of people taking an understanding of doing agriculture that may be appropriate for one landscape to another. Okay, I have a couple of examples. Many years ago, I was in Israel and I was doing some reporting. And there was a really, really interesting, I was at the Arava Center for Environmental Studies, and there's a desert plants program, and this really wonderful plant scientist named Elaine Soloway, and she was just shaking her head over what she, you know, came to understand as the folly of bringing in, you know, if you're in Israel, you go, you know, the food that there is, it's, you know, cabbages and tomatoes and you know, like lettuces and a lot of produce that is from Europe, because a lot of people came from Europe or from the U.S. to Israel, and so that's what they felt, you know, needed to be grown. But those are very water-intensive crops. And so she and others, and this is many, many years ago, so I don't really don't know what's you know, I don't have an update for that, but she was talking about the importance of developing native plants that would have food, that would have medicines, and that would be more appropriate to the landscape. So that made a big impression on me because that was, you know, that was way, way before I started, you know, really delving into these topics. And more recently, I spent time in Chihuahua, Mexico, in the Chihuahuan Desert grasslands, you know, just a couple of hours south of El Paso. And one huge challenge, okay, basically I was there, and this is in the water book, I was there to observe and meet with ranchers who were working with bird conservation organizations to restore habitat for endangered migratory grassland birds. So biodiversity is a huge, huge part of this picture. And the bird conservation groups who normally might think that ranchers were their adversaries because they had a different vision for the land, actually saw that these ranchers were, by doing really fine management and stewardship that allowed for flourishing grasslands, that they were providing habitat for these birds. So they were very excited about this. Now, one, I mean, this is one of these things that there have been really positive developments that more and more ranchers are realizing that, you know, this is better for them, this is better for the land, and, you know, they're really increasing the acreage of, hugely increasing the acreage of land under management that supports biodiversity and healthy grasslands. But at the same time, another trend is that there's a huge, huge number, I mean, over 100,000 Mennonite farmers in that region. And so these are people who originally came from Europe, maybe came to Mexico directly. Many of them went via Canada. And because all the people were doing poor management, you know, they weren't managing the ranches well. These ranches were going out of business, selling the land cheap. These Mennonite farmers were coming in, plowing up the land, you know, because it's basically, you know, it's been grasslands forever, and just plowing it up, dousing it with chemicals, creating biological deserts, and growing crops, you know, the same kinds of crops that you would grow, you know, the cabbages and the like, that you would grow in, let's say, Eastern Europe and Canada. So, you know, it's a real challenge, and it's... yeah, and it was destroying the land, and or is destroying the land. I have to say that I have such admiration for these ranchers in Chihuahua because they are so patient and working so hard. And Alejandro Carrillo, the rancher that was kind of my guide to this area, I just talked to him recently for another article that I'm doing, and he told me that the Mennonite farmers are now interested in what they're doing because they're seeing problems with their style of agriculture. One thing is that, you know, the water resources are, you know, becoming quite a problem. People are getting sick because of the chemicals, and they're seeing, okay, that there is a better way. So their patience and, you know, working closely with people in their region is paying off, and we could be on the verge of a very positive shift where people who had practiced this agriculture that was harming their water and not making a good use of water, you know, moving to a more regenerative direction. So that's exciting. About the water, I want to say one thing, and this I'm sure will lead to another question, but, you know, when you're talking about how people, you know, are really looking at foods and how much water different foods, you know, use in their production, I think it's important to say that with regenerative stewardship, you are actually creating water on the landscape. So it's not even a matter of how much water is used. It's you are building water. So because, well, you know, in a very simple way, you're holding it in the landscape, you know, as opposed to, you know, kind of using it as needed and in an environment that isn't able to, you know, retain it.
Yeah, it's kind of like we've had several shows where this has been extensively discussed. And I just want to refer listeners to the show last summer with Fred Kirschenman. And, you know, we've had like a whole, we've also had shows with a whole host of different people, Mark Cohen, discussing this. And my understanding is it's like the difference between a sieve, you know, with big holes that are all just drains through, and then, you know, isn't held by that. And so therefore it runs off, it evaporates out. All of this stuff happens versus land that's more like a sponge that expands to hold the water. And also it has a climate impact because it's holding the carbon as well in the soil rather than all of that evaporating into the atmosphere. And, you know, so there's also, you know, a kind of climate mitigation effect that we've discussed on past programs. And, you know, people can hear more an extensive discussion of this exact point, but I'm glad that you brought it up because without the, you know, without our mentioning it, you know, the mechanisms, you know, the kind of natural cycles and mechanisms that, you know, are there to naturally sustain and restore, we're not making use of them, you know, and instead we're, you know, kind of turning to technology without, you know, which is kind of abstracted without realizing that there are natural, you know, kind of mechanisms and ecologies that perform a function in a way that that really can work. You know, let's just shift gears and talk a little bit more about the role of water in both a changing climate, which we now unfortunately have, as well as its, you know, restorative and helpful function in sustaining a more biologically compatible climate for humans and other species.
Excellent, because that is the second reason I was compelled to write this book on water, is that when the connection between water and climate is discussed, it always tends to go in one direction, and that is that a changing climate will put added stress on water sources throughout the world, which is, of course, really, really important and, you know, and alarming and something we need to deal with. But what hasn't been talked about is water's effect on climate. And that's what truly blew my mind. You know, the huge, huge opportunities that we have to enhance the Earth's natural climate regulating processes. And, you know, we have not even touched upon them, and it's just really exciting. So, yes, this is absolutely something I love to talk about. So, you know, one thing I, in doing this work, I often think about is that, you know, what we do is often determined by what questions we ask, the quality of the questions we ask. And in terms of climate, you know, what I think has been missing and what I think can open up huge areas of exploration and restoration is asking the question, how does the Earth regulate climate? And, you know, hugely it's through water-based processes. So, you know, what? So I like to, you know, when I think about water, we often think about it as a noun. I like to think about it as a verb and talk about water processes. So, you know, we've been talking a little bit without naming it about water infiltration, which is water infiltrating into the natural environment and being held like a, you know, in the soil. And in order to do that, you need, you know, like carbon-rich soil. So just to kind of connect the carbon dot there is that for every 1% increase in carbon in the soil, that represents an added 20,000 gallons of water per acre that can be held on the land. That's figures from the USDA. And so when you're holding water on the land, that means, you know, as we've talked about, that you don't need irrigation, you're using the water more effectively, you're hydrating the landscape, which is huge in terms of, let's say, wildfire risk. And as a friend of mine puts it, it makes it that much harder to make a flood. You know, so you look at all the floods we've had. If we had, you know, and here in Vermont, we had Hurricane Irene. If we had, you know, carbon-rich soil, you know, instead of, you know, some of the problems that unfortunately we do have in Vermont, like everywhere, maybe it would not have had as much, you know, the devastating impact that it had. So that's infiltration. What's really exciting is transpiration, okay? And, you know, we don't really talk about it much. Transpiration is very basically the upward movement of water through plants. So, the most important, you know, really basic thing to know about it is that that uses and that absorbs and that diffuses energy. It's a cooling process. So, you know, you look around any landscape and those plants, whenever you have plants, those plants are taking, you know, the water that comes up, you know, that they take up through the roots and they use for their growing, you know, for all of their metabolic functions. And then water vapor is, you know, emitted. And that's just really, it turns out to be really important on many levels. One is that it is a cooling process. It uses energy. And also when you have, you know, like forests where there's a lot of transpiration going on, that creates the dynamic where you're keeping water on the landscape and actually even pulling in moisture because it's like this pump. You know, you think that you can start to think about plants as a pump, that they're kind of drawing down carbon through the liquid carbon pathway, and then they're pushing out moisture. And so I'm trying to remember the, numbers don't always stick with me, but I talked to, there's a really interesting scientist who works on this from Brazil. His name is Antonio Nobre, and he was talking about how, like, the amount of transpiration occurring in the Amazon rainforest, you know, like how many, you know, nuclear reactors worth of energy this represents in time. And it's huge. And,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. So once you start tuning into water vapor and transpiring plants, it's kind of amazing. So also in the Amazon rainforest, he talks about how the amount of the transpiring plants, the trees, are creating an aerial river, like a river in the sky that is actually has five times as much moisture as the Amazon River itself. So there's water is the most effective conveyor of energy, heat energy, of any substance. And when you think about that, so it's continually moving energy, you know, heat, you know, it's dispersing and moving energy and all over. It's like this whole other realm that we are barely tapped into. It's also very difficult to model. And, you know, I'm wondering whether that's one reason why we've been focused on carbon, because carbon is easier to model than water, you know, than the changes of water, the changing phase states of water, because that's where a lot of the, you know, energy transfer takes place. And then you have condensation, of course. So ideally, you know, in an ideal universe that, you know, you have heat, and so the plants are kind of taking that heat energy and then they're, you know, putting it up into clouds. And then with condensation, it becomes raindrops and the rain falls, you know, and then that releases heat in an area where you need heat. It's much more nuanced than that. So mostly the release of heat that you get with condensation happens higher up. So the heat is, brought back into the higher atmosphere and it doesn't hit the earth. So I feel like I want to say
that would be a better idea. I'm just going to interject a joke here. That would be a better idea than bombarding the earth with a meteor to move it further from the sun, so that, you know, we have a cooling effect from that, as has been proposed as one of these, you know, kind of gazillion-dollar high technology fixes.
Exactly.
You know, as if
exactly.
It's a sport,
these are right. These are processes that happen naturally. So mm-hmm. I'm going to refer to this a scientist whose work has informed me greatly. Mm-hmm. His name is Walter Yenna, and he's a soil microbiologist in Australia. And you know, he does a lot of work about this. I mean, he has an amazing paper about 10 ways to work with the water cycle to promote earth cooling. So what he explains is that, so, you know, the earth, we have this continual taking in of solar energy and using the solar energy, and, you know, it's the energy cycle. So what he says is that, you know, on average, every square meter of the planet receives 342 watts of solar energy a day. Now, because of the ways that we have altered the planet, having to do with changing of the surface of the Earth, is that we are now, I think that like we are now taking in the 342 watts per square meter, but we are only re-emitting 339 watts per square meter. So that's a 3 watts per square meter differential. And if you think about it that way, you know, well, what could we do in a healthy, restorative way that could re-radiate those 3 watts per square meter? Because that's less mm-hmm. than 1%.
Hmm.
And quite basically, wow. we could have plants transpiring and, you know, bringing and, you know, dispersing that heat and, you know, sending it up as vapor that would then condense. And, you know, we're basically talking about the energy cycle, which I think gets lost in a lot of our climate discussions. I'm going to put it another way that has mm-hmm. helped me understand this. Okay, because
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
we're getting into some pretty, you know, like some pretty deep physics. Okay, so there is another Australian, a fellow named Peter Andrews, and he is a really interesting farmer, thinker, horse breeder, author. And in one of his books, I can't remember if it's Beyond the Brink or Back from the Brink, he wrote that, just a really simple statement, plants manage water, and in managing water, they are managing heat. So, and then he points out that we have devegetated about one quarter of the planet from our building, from our cities, and also from the process of desertification, where the land does not have the capacity to, you know, support the plant life that it had. So, so through the process of writing this book on water, what I came to, the understanding I came to that I didn't expect to, was the extent to which plants are running the show, the power of plants.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, right.
Yeah, that's really kind of, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, in my sort of simple-minded mind, that kind of connects with the idea that instead of having, you know, these sort of pristine lawns and feeding them all these chemicals and then having to water them, and, you know, that instead it's preferable where possible to sort of deviate from the concept of the lawn that we've all been, you know, taught is the appropriate surrounding for a house or whatever, you know, or in park or wherever, you know, to the idea of ground, you know, cover crops, which are shadier, cooler, and I guess, and, you know, retain water and don't absorb sunlight and heat up in the same way and don't, you know, and then hold water in a different manner. I mean, that's like, what you've just, I mean, this is always kind of on people's list of things that we could do, you know, if anyone, you know, has the ability to plant in an urban area or in a, around a home or whatever, you know, is to forget the lawn business and go for that. So that would be a reason for that. So it's kind of like the technology that we're looking for, so to speak, is in the plants.
Oh, very, very much so. So, mm-hmm. you know, to build on what you were saying, this is also true with agricultural lands. Rather than stripping off the vegetation after harvest to ensure that there are cover crops so that the land is always covered and that there's constant transpiration, and then, of course, that has other benefits in terms of, you know, retaining the nutrients and the minerals and not losing the carbon, because when there's bare soil, it's the carbon is oxidizing. It's combining. You're losing carbon in the ground, and it's oxidizing and becoming CO2. And roofs, and you know, every vacant lot. Everything. Plants everywhere. There's another group of scientists that have been, you know, really inspiring to me, and I'm really pleased to see that they are inspiring many others. I'll just, you know, put something out here right now that there's the Sustainable Design Masterclass that has been doing a series of webinars called The New Water Paradigm, and there's one tomorrow that is at, I think it's at 2:00 Eastern Standard Time, but you can look up the New Water Paradigm. So there are a group of and the Sustainable Design Masterclass. They're free to watch or over the next few days, and I think they're keeping some of them free of charge. So there's a group of Eastern Europeans that have worked under the title The New Water Paradigm, and now they're calling themselves Rain for Climate. But the science is basically the same, and it's very, very simple when you think about it, that you know, as we're talking about the importance of keeping water on the landscape and why this is so important from a climate point of view, is that just let's say that, you know, we're talking about the energy cycle in the most basic sense of what happens when sunlight meets the earth. So if you have a parking lot, okay, so we're in a parking lot, and the sun beams down, well, what is happening? The surface is absorbing that heat, and it's, you know, it heats up. It becomes sensible heat, which is heat you can feel. And if you, you know, if this was on, you know, ground that was bare dirt, you know, it's also heating up, and then it's also, you know, too hot for the microorganisms. So, you know, that's when you get the desertification process. Now, if you have that same bit of sunlight falling down on a healthy meadow, all those plants are transpiring, so it's cooling. So, you know, that's the basic energy cycle right there. And this group, the New Water Paradigm, talk about all the ways that we can hold water on the landscape for cooling, for you know, keeping plants going, for, you know, just for keeping our overall ecosystems thriving.
That's fascinating. I wonder if there's a, you know, speaking from the Northeast, I'm wondering if there's a ground cover crop that, you know, just people could plant around their homes that also, you know, is not a tick haven, you know, that the ticks don't like, you know, you know, rather than, you know, you plant a cover crop and then all the deer come running in and then, you know, there's like a tick problem. This is like, you know, a problem in the Northeast. I mean, you have to kind of think interactively about all of these different things. But
absolutely. And I have found the discipline of permaculture to be really helpful. I mean, I'm just a very early student of this, but just to design our systems in a way that allows those systems to flourish. You know, and you know, I think, you know, one undercurrent of things that we've been talking about, and I, you know, understand that you've been talking about in other of your discussions, is that we've had, like, in our technological mindset, we've had this tendency to simplify. Yeah. You know, because it's, everything is one problem, one solution. but or this is what we want and this is most economical, so we're going to do this and ignore and, you know, make sure that we don't have all these other things going on. You know, the monoculture mindset. But we're seeing that diversity is so helpful to all of these functions. So
that's really true. And I think the whole thing, somebody asked me the other day, if I, had a choice to sort of shut down social media and the internet for 5 years so that, everybody would kind of calm down and return to their, slower paced thought processes, would I do it? And I don't think I would, because, we have many things we have to keep an eye on. And, as tempting as it is to go local, if you're in a place that, appears, that's currently a good place locally, it may not be a good place for long if we can't all communicate and know what's going on and learn new ways of thought and new opportunities for healing our overall situation. So I don't think I would vote for that. But it's also true that as attention spans have shortened, we're just looking for, give me the answer, what's the bottom line, how much will it cost, so even, people who are striving to function in some kind of holistic manner are still, we all are very heavily programmed in this regard. And then if it's more complex and it's like, you've got a 3 or 5 pointed idea, it's more challenging, it's harder to hold in mind, to just kind of sit back and allow that to sink in and kind of knit in some kind of way, which is maybe more in conformance with both the natural methods and the traditional ways that some of this has functioned and which we now, are in the process of trying to recapture and recreate. Where does that apply? And so, for people who maybe are not going to be growing food, who may not have a garden or whatever, it applies through our food choices. It applies through the things that we know about or support. I mean, this past week, you and I had reconnected around a water charity that kind of sprang up that seemed to have a really high budget for a nonprofit organization helping Africans. And had very appealing, kind of marketing and imagery with a lot of, apparently idealistic young people traveling around the world to, kind of bring water to Africa. And, we took a deeper look into it. They were bringing, again, temperate zone technology. There weren't noticeably Africans in charge and directing this. It seemed to be an investment opportunity for countries outside of Africa. It had a number of different sort of telltales. And, they may still be doing something that's needed in some location. And then for me, the starkest thing of all was that, we're bringing water to Africa, hooray. And, a lot of my friends were signing on to donate and invite their friends to donate. And that, yet they were notably missing South Africa, which has a terrible water crisis. So if they're bringing a solution, but not to the place that is most palpably in crisis, it's like, is this the right solution for Africa? Because you have like an end stage problem in South Africa, which, has a water crisis right now, for listeners who don't know. And, and here's this group, we're bringing water to Africa, but we're leaving out the place it's in dire crisis. And it's sort of, I know that we haven't delved to the bottom of it, but this is how our dialogue reignited. So, it's like, even if it isn't about an immediate consumer choice, consuming soil grown organic versus, hydroponically grown so-called organic is like one consumer choice, but also just knowing, what the overarching needs are and whether something that we want to support is even ticking off all the boxes, is important. And that's how we reignited our conversation. We're kind of coming down to the end of the show, but I just, kind of going into how this applies to you and me a little bit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's,
you know,
it's a real challenge to be connected both locally and globally. And, yeah, and often the, you know, the snazzy marketing does catch our eye, but it's so important to in when we're dealing with, you know, third world, developing world challenges, to involve the local people there in coming to their, you know, in developing solutions, and to ensure that people everywhere have the agency to do so, and not to just export what we call our solutions, because often those are really investment opportunities masking as charity, and that scares me hugely.
Me too. So water, a charity, buyer beware, folks. Well, we're coming to the end of our conversation with Judith D. Schwartz. It's just been terrific. I just want to mention a few things for takeaways for listeners. The upcoming event on the new water paradigm that Judy talked about can be found at www.sustainabledesignmasterclass.com/the-masterclass. And that's coming up tomorrow and will replay for several days. And they also have other programs that they've already held. Go out and read Judy's books, Judith B. Schwartz's books, Water in Plain Sight, a publication by Macmillan. It's her most recent, and her classic book, Cows Save the Planet, published by Chelsea Green. Thank you so much for all the work you've been doing. It's definitely high time that you come back, because you're really, your work is evolving so organically and beautifully. It's a pleasure to have you back on Connect the Dots, Judith B. Schwartz.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Allison.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of Connect the Dots. Be well, keep marching forward, head up. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Great week.